In this episode, I interview a bishop who once quit home teaching.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. This is Kurt Frankum, the host, and really just the guy that sits in front of the mic and calls himself the host. I appreciate everybody listening in, and I know some of you never miss an episode. I know some of you catch an episode when you can, and for all of you, no matter how often you listen, I appreciate you. And I'm really getting excited because I'm recording this in the first, second week of April, and I'm getting ahead of schedule with interviews. So probably by the time you're listening to this episode, you've had a few consecutive weeks of how I lead interviews. And I've realized as I record these, I talk with a lot of bishops, okay? I realize this. And I hope those primary presidents out there still listen in, or Relief Society presidents still listen in. But the reality is I need to create some equality in this world of leading LDS. And so I'm looking for primary presidents, Relief Society presidents, anybody other than bishops. Again, I not that I don't want to talk with the bishops. If you have a good bishop, I'd love to still talk with them. But I want to get even, you know, ward mission leaders on here and really balance it out as far as the callings we talk to, because I think we'll reach a broader audience that way and help more leaders. This is another segment of How I Lead, where I sit down with some of the most prolific leaders in the church, whether they think so or not, and just ask some questions about how they lead. And what comes to the surface is usually really interesting information. And in this episode, we go down to Texas, in Huntsville, Texas, and I speak with Bishop Scott Bumbaugh. And this was a very fascinating interview. I actually came across Bishop Bumbaugh a few months ago on the famous AggielandMormons.com or .org. website. And those of you that listen to every episode will remember when I talked with Bishop Sharp and also Andrew Devi, who produced the Aggieland Mormons and put on a great platform online for sharing the good things about the gospel. And I encourage you to always check out AggielandMormons.org. And a few months ago, this was back in November, actually, I read the date right here on my screen. There was an article where the title of the article just jumped out at me. It said, "What happened when I quit home teaching?" And I thought, oh, I got to read this. This is interesting. And so I read it, and it's actually written by Scott Bumbaugh, who's the Huntsville Ward Bishop. And now he did quit home teaching, but he has since had a change of heart. And we talk about that story in this interview, and it's engaging. We go over all sorts of things as far as feeding the flock, how to lead by serving, thinking outside the box, focusing on the little things as a leader. So this is a good one. This is worth sharing. And he's got a great bishop laugh. Okay. He sounds like a wonderful, loving bishop. And so here's my interview with Bishop Scott Bumbaugh. So today I'm with Scott Bumbaugh. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Good. Now you're down in Texas, Huntsville, Texas, not to be confused with Huntsville, Utah. And you said Huntsville, Alabama as well, right?
That's correct.
Great. And are you born and raised in Texas, or how did you end up in Huntsville, Texas?
Well, no, I'm not a native Texan. I was actually born in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. My mom and dad are both from Pennsylvania. And it's a long story, but suffice to say, I moved down to Texas in 1982 with the plans of working for a year for the prison system here, saving my money, and then going back to Brigham Young University, where I could finish my education without having to worry about financing. And after moving down here, I met my future wife. She was attending the ward here, and she kind of convinced me to just transfer my school records from BYU to Sam Houston State University. And so I did, and the rest is history. I haven't gone anywhere since 1982.
Yeah, spouses seem to influence us that way, that sometimes they want to stay where they're at, and obviously for the marriage to move forward, that's just the way it's going to be.
That's so, it, yes.
I would imagine you've enjoyed your time in Texas.
Yeah, I have. It's a nice place.
Good. Good. So did you ever make it to BYU then?
I mean, go back?
As far as going to be educated there, or where did you say you did your education?
I started off at Brigham Young, 77 okay. to 78, and then I went on my mission. And okay. When I came back, I went back to Brigham Young for a semester, and the economy had taken a downturn. That was 1980, 81, I guess. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the Texas prison system was hiring, and I thought I can make pretty good money and save it all, and then go back up north. But my parents wound up being unemployed at that time, and so I helped them with their bills. And
gotcha.
That by that time I met my future wife, and the rest was history.
Great, great. So growing up in Pennsylvania, did you have? Were you born and raised in the church?
No. My dad was in the military. We were raised a German Reformed Church. That was my mother's family's religion, which is very similar to the Lutherans. My dad's side were mainly Presbyterian and Baptist. And so when my dad was in the military in 1957, he joined the church in Germany. And but he was completely inactive, so much so that I didn't even know that he was LDS. And we had gone over to Germany on two different times. One, 67 to 69 was the first tour. And then my father went to Vietnam in 69. And when he came back in 1970, we went back to Germany. And that's when I met some LDS youth on our school bus. And they introduced me to the church, and I started going to church with them and found it absolutely fascinating, and decided that I wanted to join the church. And that's when I found out my dad was LDS.
Oh, wow. Okay. And how old were you at that time, did you say?
I was 13. I remember I wanted to get baptized and was told that I'd have to get my parents' permission, which really terrified me. So I waited for them to have a big party at their house. And I figured they couldn't get mad in front of the company. And
yeah.
So, you know, I told them, and that's when my mom said, well, you know, your father is a member of that church. And I was totally flabbergasted. And she said, wow. We'll talk about this later. And so we did.
Good. And the conversation went well?
It did go well. We had the missionaries come over, and they taught the whole family. In those days, we could get one lesson a week. And so I think there were a total of 8 lessons. So there were 2 months worth of missionary discussions, and at the end they asked who wanted to be baptized, and of course I said yes, and was very surprised when my mother and my sister said that they wanted to be baptized too.
Oh, really?
So
wow.
We were all baptized on the same day, 14th of April, 1973.
And did everybody from that point become pretty devout from that day forward?
My dad took some time getting reactivated, actually.
Okay.
But yeah, my mom and dad eventually went and got sealed in the temple. And my dad died in 92 before my sister and I could be sealed to them. So my sister and I went with my mom, and we were sealed in the Oklahoma City temple.
Oh, what a great story. And so a few years passed, and then you headed off on a mission.
Yes, 78, I got called to the Kobe, Japan mission, and was there from 78 to 80.
And how was the church in Japan during that time? You can find some members there. I mean, there's temples and things like that, but how was that experience with the church?
The church was going through a growth period at that time. We were doing a lot of teaching. I guess, you know, looking back at my journals, I think there were about 25 people that I was instrumental in teaching that later joined the church, either when I was the missionary or later down the road after I got transferred out. So, you know, coming home, we went up to, we flew out of Tokyo, and the Tokyo Temple was just being built. And I think they've got, I know they've got at least 2, maybe 3 temples in Japan now. And so they've got third generation LDS families there, so that growth is really continuing on.
Interesting. Now, was there a strong turning point on your mission spiritually, would you say? I mean, obviously, not that you turned away, but was it from you at the time that you went on a, or that you were baptized, that you continued to just flourish in the gospel? Or do you kind of look at other times in your youth and maybe your young adulthood where your strength was really really strengthened?
Well, I think my time on my mission was a spiritually trying time. The language was very hard. I speak German, and I had really prepared to go on a European mission. I did enjoy my mission. I really enjoyed the culture. In fact, I had a LDS friend over there that said, "Scott, you're a lot more Japanese than a lot of Japanese," which I took as a compliment.
Wow, yeah, sure.
But it was difficult. And I often tell the missionaries that serve here in our ward, you know, I was ready to pack it up every 6 months and come home. But I stuck it out, and I'm glad I did, because I learned a tremendous number of lessons that I've been able to apply later on down the road. Sometimes, and then when I talk to young men who are preparing for missions, I tell them, you know, you hear so many great things, great stories about serving missions as the best 2 years of your life. I said, yes, it can be, but don't think that it's going to be carefree and easy, because that it is not. You're going to have a lot of trial, and it's a lot of work. It's very hard work, physically, emotionally, spiritually. It's hard work.
Yeah, I would definitely add to that that, you know, there's weeks on end that do not feel at all like the best time, the best 2 years of your life. You know, you just sort of get through those tough times. Then throughout there's sprinkled some incredible moments that really have the power to change individuals. So, fantastic experience. And so you came home from your mission, and then how soon after that were you married?
Well, let me see. I came home in 1980 and went back to BYU for another semester in 81. And then 81 came down to Texas and met my wife, I guess, in 82. It was at a young single adult party here in town. And she would not have anything to do with me for a while. But I was persistent. And
good.
We were married in 84, engaged in 83. And we were waiting for the Dallas Temple to be built and dedicated. But they kept delaying that, so we eventually just decided to go back to Washington, D.C., since I had family in Pennsylvania. And so we've been married since 1984.
Great. And I read on your bio that on Aggieland Mormon that you are currently a high school teacher and teach German, right?
That is correct, yes.
So did you learn German from your father's experience in the military there in Germany? Or
yes.
Okay. Just from a young child, you learned.
Right. The first 2 years that we were there, we went over in 67, and we could not get military housing on base. And so we lived about 20 miles off base, out literally in the woods, small village called Waldstetten, about 500 people. There were two other people in town that spoke English, and one was our landlady. And so my sister and I wanted to play with kids. We had to play with the local kids, and that's where we picked up the German. And then when we went back, you know, of course, that was fifth, sixth, seventh grade. And so we had it as part of our education in school, in the Department of Ed schools. And I decided then that I wanted to teach German, and so that's what I pursued. So it came as a kind of a shock when I got a call to Japan.
Yeah. So do you also teach Japanese at school, or nobody has interest in that?
Oh, there was an interest, but I'm not certified to teach Japanese.
Oh, I see.
I looked at it several years ago, and it would have been a nice feather in my cap, but the time factor, I would have had to go to Austin at the time and go about every 2 months for seminars and then take the test.
Yeah.
I just decided it was wasn't worth it.
But I would imagine your Japanese is still fluent?
I would not say fluent,
okay.
But I've been to Japan twice since then, and took my sons over, and, you know, I can take care of the necessities, you know, find
sure.
a place to eat, and if you're lost, get help, and be able to negotiate the train system and the subways and that sort of thing.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's about where my mission Spanish is at as well. I can get by pretty well, and so So what encouraged you or what influenced you to become a high school teacher?
Well, when I came back from Germany the first time in 69, when my father went to Vietnam, I remember I had a bunch of friends that said, teach us how to speak German. And my mother's father had a dairy farm, and that's all that I ever really wanted to do was be a farmer. And but I was not in line to inherit the farm. My mother had an older brother, and he had children, and I knew that I probably would never be able to afford to buy my own farm. And when my friends asked me to teach them German, standing there at the chalkboard in that fifth grade class in Bedford, Pennsylvania, it was just like, wow, this is so much fun. This is what I want to do. And so I decided right then and there that I wanted to be a teacher.
Nice. And did it take much? Did you have a degree at that time, or did you? That's sort of what influenced you to get your degree in teaching.
That's what influenced me to get my degree in teaching.
Gotcha. Uh-huh. Gotcha. And so how many years now has it been since you started teaching?
Oh, gosh. I think this is year 23.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
24. This is year 24 for me.
Great. So you're about halfway done?
people often ask when I'm going to retire. And I always tell them, I say, you know, my last probable vision going from this life into the next is some teenager trying to practice CPR on me saying, don't go, Mr. Bumbaugh. So right now I enjoy teaching and I don't want to think about retiring. I always tell my wife, as long as I'm healthy and I enjoy what I'm doing, I'm going to stick
with
it. And I'm too young.
You're too young. Okay. So I first came across your name through Aggieland Mormons as I followed various continents up there. And we've had, you know, Bishop Sharp on the podcast along with Andrew Devy.
Andrew Devy?
As well. Uh-huh. Yeah. When we talked about Aggieland Mormons and the good work that they're doing over there. And when I saw the title of the article you wrote, which is What Happened When I Quit Home Teaching, I was definitely intrigued, and I thought, I got to read this story. So, and this is kind of an experience you've had with home teaching, and I encourage all listening to go check it out, and it's a really good read. But would you mind just kind of summarizing that experience with us and what you learned about home teaching?
Sure. I don't know how many years ago it was, but there was a time when I just decided it was not worth home teaching. You know, I was still in college at the time, and you know, I had a young family, and it was, to put it mildly, I believed it was a hassle. And so I quit home teaching, even though the ward really tried to encourage me to do that. They gave me some wonderful families that lived close, and I was friendly with them, but I just didn't do my home teaching. And so one evening, I had a phone call from Brother Hal Toole. At the time, he was serving on the High Council. Now he's our lead clerk here in the ward. And so anyway, Hal called me up and said, I'd like to have a meeting with you. President Cutler has wanted me to ask interview you. So I said, sure, I'll come up. And I got up there, and there was a pretty long line of other brethren. So I'm sure that they were all being challenged to do their home teaching.
Interesting. Okay.
But, you know, I went in and sat down with Hal, and we had an opening prayer, and Hal basically said, well, we'd like you to do your home teaching. And I told Hal at the time, I said, Hal, I'm not going to do it. I said, it doesn't make any difference whether I home teach. It does not make any difference if I don't home teach. And, you know, it's just a waste of time for everybody involved. And I think Brother Toole was a little taken aback. I'm pretty sure that the other guys that had been in there said, oh, yeah, I'll do it. And I don't know if they did or not, but I just told him flat out, I'm not going to do this. And so he thanked me, and I packed up my stuff and felt pretty smug about it, I'll be honest, and got in my car and drove down the road. And just maybe 2-3 minutes away from our church building, there's a four-way stop. And I had come up to the stop and waited for a car to pass, and I heard a voice. And it's interesting, the Spirit always calls you by your first name. And it said, Scott, what is it going to hurt you to do your home teaching? And I remember it really shocked me hearing that. And it was almost like, what? And it said, what is it going to hurt you to do your home teaching? And so by now it was time to turn. And so I turned onto the road and continued going down. And the more I thought about that, you know, people often talk about the warm fuzzies you get when the Spirit talks to you. Well, uh-huh. I got those warm fuzzies on the ride home, and it's just a 5-minute ride. And, you know, I could argue with Hal Tool. I could argue with all my priesthood leaders, but I couldn't argue with the Spirit. And I decided then that I would do my home teaching, though I have to confess that I did it on the sly.
And, okay.
You know, tried not to let anybody know that I was doing it because I figured that something else would happen. And sure enough, something else did happen. I was eventually called to be the Elders Quorum president after I started teaching. But it was a great change in my life when I did that.
Yeah, that's great. And it's inspiring to hear, you know, the example of those leaders that were taking the time to call people in and really put that challenge there. And obviously it worked for you, if not many others, to reassess sort of your desire to home teach. So since then, I mean, do you feel like home teaching has always been a strong highlight in your service in the church?
I have really tried. Yes, I have tried. I guess that here recently I've had up to 10 families that I home teach. And both my stake president and my high priest group leader and the elders quorum president all say this is too much. And I always tell them, well, if you take them away, who's going to go on home teaching? And quite a few of them are very less active. I could even use the term inactive. Some are partially active, part member families, and some are completely active. And I've come to love all of them. I've grown to love them all. And I do worry about them all. And several years ago, they actually took one of the families away, and they never got home taught. And so after I got to be the bishop, I told the elders quorum president then, I said, you reassign that family to me because I will home teach them.
And nice.
So they generally don't mess with my requests.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the other part of the article that intrigued me is as I read your bio at the end, it said that you're currently serving as the bishop of the Huntsville ward. Tell me about what was your experience like being called as bishop?
I cried.
Cried at what type of tears were coming?
They were unhappy tears.
Oh, no.
I had served previous to my call as bishop. I had served as the second counselor in the bishopric here. And I had Bishop Boyle was a great example, but he delegated a lot. And so I was very busy as a second counselor. And attended, you know, most of the youth activities. He asked me to do that since I was a high school teacher. And so anyway, a few months before I got called to be the bishop, I just got this prompting that the bishopric is going to be released. I feel it. And so I went in and we had bishopric one day and I looked at Mike and I said, Mike, have they talked to you about being released? And he said, no, why? And I said, I just feel like we're going to be released soon. And he kind of laughed. And now, you know, looking back, I realized that, yeah, he knew something was up. And we had gone up to Utah in July. Let me think. It's going to be 5 years this August. So 2011. And our stake president's youngest son was getting married, and they had invited us to the wedding. We're very good friends, and have been ever since they moved to town. And so he asked me to come in and help what he said was arrange chairs. And I thought that they might be having a little reception going on. And so, you know, I'm completely naive. And he said, well, let's get Loretha in here, too. That's my wife. And I thought, well, that's odd. Why would he ask Loretha to arrange chairs? And so I went in, and this time he had pulled up these big kind of armchairs that were there at the hotel. And I thought, oh, something is up. And he sat us down there, and he asked if I would serve as the bishop. And I was very unhappy, and went through every possible man in the ward. And President Pryor said, "No, the Lord wants you to serve." And I just felt totally inadequate. And so he said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you some time to think about it. Why don't you go up to your hotel room with your wife and you know, give it some thought and some prayer, and then think about it in the temple, you know, because my son's getting married, so you can think about it in the temple."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No arm twisting, right?
You're right.
So
you're right.
We got on the elevator and we were heading up, and I was really thinking, I'm going to say no. I just can't do this.
And, so let me jump in and ask, sure. were there feelings of, was it like dread of just taking on that responsibility, or was it just you knew what it would take, and so you really felt like you weren't up to par with what it would take? How would you define those feelings?
It was all of the above. I dreaded it because I had been in a bishopric for 5 years, and I knew the amount of work, and I knew the burden put on the previous bishop. I also felt like, you know, I don't think I'm a very good leader. I think I'm more of, rather than being a chief, I much prefer to be a supporter to the chief. You know, tell me what to do and I'll go and do it. And and I was tired. You know, like I said, Bishop Boyle had used me well those 5 years. And I was looking forward to being released and just being, quote unquote, a normal member again. And I got on the elevator and was thinking, no, I'm going to tell President Pryor, no, thank you for the invitation, but can't do this. And it was right then that I had a very quick vision, if I may use that term, and I saw my two sons' faces. And Loretha looked at me and she says, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I have to accept this call because of our sons." And so I went back and I told President Pryor, I said, "I don't want this calling." I said, "But I know that I have to accept the call." And so I did. And later down the road, I understood why that I needed to accept that call for my boys.
Wow. What a great, great experience. And I think it's good for other leaders to hear that, that, I mean, obviously, these aren't easy questions to answer when somebody asks you to serve in such a capacity.
It's,
I mean,
it's
that
a huge capacity.
Goes without saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How would you describe the demographics of your ward, or even the geographics? What's unique about it? Those types of things.
Well, we're the largest unit in our state, not by population. Well, maybe by population too. We actually cover our entire county plus parts of three other counties. So we're very diffuse here. We have slightly over 500 members, and I would say that our average sacrament attendance fluctuates anywhere between 180 and 210, 220, depending on what's going on. And out of that, we've got about 30, 35 high priests. We've got about 70 elders, though only about 10 of those are active. So we're high priest heavy and elder poor.
And I see.
A huge number of prospective elders. We have a good sized youth program. We have about 50 youth, divided fairly evenly between the boys and the girls. A growing primary, which is a blessing because for a long time we were a pretty old ward. And we've had a lot of young couples move in to go to college here or to work at the prison system or at the university and so on. So, but yeah, it's a huge area that we cover, and with a lot of different needs, everything from extremely well-educated people teaching at the university to people who have barely a grammar school education.
Gotcha. And so how long would it take to drive from one side of the border to the next, roughly speaking?
Well, if you go from the south side to the north, it would probably take you 15, half hour, probably a good hour from north to south. From mm-hmm. east to west, probably hour and a half.
Okay. And looking back, I mean, just considering your experience as a high school teacher, obviously you said the previous bishop you served with had you work closely with the youth since that's what you do day to day. Has that influenced you anyway, or do you feel like helped you serve more comfortably with the youth, or what would you say along those lines?
I think serving with the youth has helped me in all aspects of my calling as a bishop. Number one, you know, when you teach youth, when you work with kids on a daily basis, it keeps you young. And you have to learn patience when you're working with young people. And that is one of the things that I certainly have developed over the years, first in the bishopric with Bishop Boyle, but personally as the bishop now, is just to learn to be patient. And so I think that has been a tender mercy of the Lord in my life, is that the calling of my job as teacher has blessed me in my callings that I've had in the ward. I also, you know, try very hard as a bishop to make sure that the flock is well nurtured. And so I take my role as a teacher also very seriously at church.
Yeah. Gotcha. And so does that mean you teach quite often at church?
Well, when I was called to be the bishop, President Pryor encouraged us to take the opportunities to, quote unquote, feed the flock. And so I understood that at the time, that he really would like to have the bishopric teach. Now, we don't teach every week, but we do take turns. And so I'll teach one sacrament lesson 1 month. And then the next month, one of my counselors will do that. And then the third month, another one will do that. And we rotate that. And, of course, we can't do it every month, but we do try to either do it in sacrament meeting or do it in a fifth Sunday lesson, some type of what we feel is important for the ward to hear.
Gotcha. Any thoughts coming to mind when you think about how you balance administering to your ward versus ministering to your ward?
I have been very blessed to have awesome auxiliary and quorum presidencies, and so the administering is relatively easy. There are some things that I just have to do either as the bishop or as a member of the bishopric. But most of it I try to delegate to the presidencies and let them run with the ball. I think, you know, as a teacher, I always try to get my kids to own the material and do something with it. And as a leader in the ward, you know, I've got a very short period of time that I'm going to be the bishop, and eventually I'm going to have to pass the ball to somebody else. And the more experience that they can have in serving, they are going to also learn some quote unquote tricks of the trade that they can use when and if they are called to be a bishop or a member of the bishopric or some other calling in the ward. So we have to grow our leadership and trust the members enough to do what is right. And I've been blessed in that capacity. I've got some great presidencies working with me.
Great. I know that, you know, any leader, they're kind of faced with the task of teaching on in various settings, whether it's sacrament meeting or a fifth Sunday or you know, even just a Sunday school class. And you mentioned this idea of owning the material and do something with it. Is there any specific example you could talk about where, as far as how you go about doing that and encourage them to own the material and do something with it? Do something with it, I should say.
Well, I know that, you know, with the emphasis on making the sacrament meeting a spiritual feast, I have the bishopric here, we've all tried to teach from the scriptures and from the words of the living prophets. And as we ask other individuals to speak in sacrament or to teach in quorums or in Sunday school relief society, that has been our big push. Teach from the scriptures, teach doctrine, teach from the you know, what the prophet is teaching us, what the apostles are teaching us, and go over that over and over and over again. And I have seen a huge improvement in the lessons given all across the board. And when we got the invitation from the Brethren in Salt Lake several years ago to really focus on the sacrament meeting in ward councils, we watched that that video as we talked about it in ward council and in PEC. We got everybody pretty much, this is what we need to do. One of the things we also try to do is to correlate what we are teaching in sacrament meeting with what the youth are learning in Sunday school. We don't always get it perfect on that, but we do look at what's going on with the topics that the youth are learning and try to correlate that as much as possible, because we've had such a positive feedback from parents and other leaders in the ward that they get this in sacrament meeting, and then they go into the Sunday school, and the topic is the same, and it just generates so much conversation. So it's been a blessing when we look at it and try to correlate those two aspects there.
I see. That's great. Great advice. Well, you mentioned you said you've been serving about 5 years.
It'll be 5 years in August.
Okay, so maybe the release is coming sooner than later. Would you say that?
Well, I don't
Who
know.
Knows? Okay.
Sometimes I think, yeah, it's right around the corner, and then sometimes my present prior will say, "Well," he says, "you're getting to the point where the Lord can just now use you," and I just kind of, oh, I don't know how much longer I can do this.
Interesting. Okay. Well, as you, I mean, sort of look forward to that when you talk with that. The new bishop that will replace you there, are there any leadership principles or thoughts that jump to mind that you'll say to him, you know, this is really something I've learned in my 5 years that I couldn't have learned as a counselor, but I had to learn as a bishop? Anything come to mind when you think of that phrase?
Yeah, I think the most important one, at least for me, is lead by serving. And several years ago, we had a family that moved down from Illinois. Wonderful, wonderful family. And they had called and said, "We're moving in and we're going to need some help." And so I had asked our elders' quorum at the presidency at that time if they would, you know, get some people together to help move. And nothing happened. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to pick up the ball and I'm going to run with it. And so I sat down with the ward directory, and I literally called every man on the ward directory. And wow, we had a huge turnout. We had people there that had not set foot in church in I don't know how many years, but they were willing to come out and serve. And that was a lesson to me that we need to extend the invitation to others. And we yeah. should not judge them by, oh, well, they haven't come to church in 10 years, because they might be willing to do something else. And that probably leads into my second point, is you need to think outside the box. You know, we talked about home teaching, and so many people are of the impression that, oh, well, I've got to put on a white shirt and a necktie and dress slacks, and I need to make an appointment and go over and give a lesson of the ensign. And, you know, that's fine and that's good. And that's certainly a wonderful home teacher who will do that. But this the one family that I told you had been taken away for a period of time, it's a part member family. And the husband is a member, and the kids are both baptized too. And when I first started home teaching, the wife would always go into the kitchen. But as I would go over every month, I eventually noticed she started to come in and sit down when I come over. And then she'd start participating in the discussion. And it didn't happen overnight. But one of the things that I tried to do as a home teacher was remember birthdays. They got birthday cards. Remember Christmas, remember holidays. If I went on vacation, I would send a postcard. And you know, on my email account, there's a quote by William Blake, and he said, "He who would do good to another must do it in minute particulars." And I really took that to heart. It's the little things that matter. It's the little things that matter in people's lives. And if you are willing to remember the little things, then the big things will take care of themselves. And so I think those are the two principles that I would tell my the new bishop to remember. Mm-hmm. Lead through, serve through leading, lead through service, and to remember the little things.
And, awesome. Awesome. Well, let me just maybe shift gears a little bit, and I just want to talk about the week-to-week routines and habits, or the more practical side of your calling. Are there any unique approaches when you think about your meeting schedule, whether it's ward council, just day-to-day, week-to-week, what, you know, as you fulfill your responsibilities, do you take any unique approaches to your weekly meeting schedule?
Well, the first Sunday of the month, Fast Sunday, we have PEC, and I've asked the Relief Society president to be there. I've got an absolutely awesome Relief Society president, Sister Karen Williams, and she is a dynamo. And she and the Relief Society can do things that I wish the priesthood would be able to do. And so I've asked her to start attending, and she usually does, unless she has a good reason that she can't be there. And then the rest of the Sundays, we have the whole ward council. We focus on our new and returning members. That's the main part. We also, you know, ask for input on what they think should be discussed in sacrament meeting as far as talks go, because they often have their finger on the pulse of the ward. And then the last thing that we really do is I guess, calendaring. We try not to do that too much, but it's inevitable that we have to do that sort of thing.
Gotcha. And then what about your weekly bishopric meeting? Do you meet multiple times a week, or how does that work?
No. The reason we don't normally do that is I've got my second counselor is a doctor, and sometimes he's here and sometimes he's not. We have bishopric every Sunday before ward council or PEC, and generally speaking, we're all there. Then during the week, my first counselor will usually touch base with me. He'll come in, and I've got an awesome first counselor. He works very well with the youth. He's got teenage youth of his own. And but he'll come and ask if there's anything that needs to be done, and he'll run with the youth, and then I'll have either PPIs on Wednesday night or other interviews with other members or that sort of thing. So generally speaking, we have our bishopric just once a week, and then touch base either through email or texting, or a pop in on Wednesday night.
And as the bishop, how do you generally approach your weekly youth activities? Are you there every week? Do you just try to be there as much as you can?
For the youth activities, I tried to be there at the beginning, and I couldn't divide myself. So I tried to make opening exercises with the youth, and then depending on what's going on, I usually go down to my office and I have interviews or a PPI or something like that. If there's a big thing, quote unquote, that the young men are doing or the young women are doing, then I'll try to keep my calendar clear and ask my executive secretary not to schedule any appointments so that I can be there with them.
Gotcha. Great. What about technology? Are there any specific technologies you use yourself or within your bishopric or ward council that just help you manage everything?
I'm old school.
And nothing wrong with that.
No.
Pen and paper and a binder. Or
that's what I do. My first counselor is an IT person through and through. My second counselor is very good at technology as well. And so that's one of the things that, you know, I've been smart and I just delegate things to them.
Gotcha.
I tend to do pencil and paper quite a bit. I do occasionally text. I put together a monthly message from the bishopric that we put out on our ward Facebook page. I attach that to the LDS.org, our ward site there. And I send a copy to our newsletter, or not our, the sister who does our newsletter. And she puts that together and sends that out electronically, as well as prints copies for people like me who prefer the written word. So
Gotcha. All right. Well, nothing wrong with old school. So if it works, don't fix it, right? Well,
my state president says, where are you going to get a, you know, I have a laptop, but he's got a tablet and he's very tech savvy and all that. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I just, yeah. I'm not comfortable with it. And yeah. I prefer a personal touch in communication.
Gotcha.
So.
Gotcha. Cool. Now you've mentioned a little bit about Fifth Sundays, and this is a meeting that all bishops and bishoprics have to organize and plan. What's your general approach to when there's a Fifth Sunday?
We always talk about that in ward council, and we ask for some suggestions from the Relief Society, from High Priest Elders Quorum, from the Young Men, Young Women. Generally speaking, we invite the young men and young women to join us when we have those. And from the primary as well. And they always generate some great ideas for Fifth Sunday. And so I try to rely on their inspiration to give us the topic. Sometimes I'll do the whole thing. Sometimes we'll divide it up as the bishopric. I remember, several months, it's probably been about 6 months. I asked every member of the ward council that was going to be there. We were talking about home and visiting teaching. And I said, I want you to each pick a scripture relating to home and visiting teaching, and we're going to coordinate so we don't double dip. And we're all going to take 5 to 10 minutes. We're going to stand up and we're going to talk about the scripture, and we're going to engender. And that was one of the best Fifth Sundays that we ever had. It was just awesome as they got up and they bore their testimony. And I know that the Spirit was there because I felt it. And I just hope that it made some resolve in some other hearts of the sisters and brethren to go out and home teach and visit teach.
Yeah. And that sort of leads to my next question regarding home and visiting teaching. Obviously, we've talked about it from your past experience and what's motivated you to teach. I'm sure you're hitting between 95% 100% in your ward, and you figured some match count. But
I wish it was high.
Putting your personal experience aside, how have you gone about as an Elders Quorum president in the past, and now as a bishop? How do you do that? You know, how do you be the leader that's challenging others to home teach, or how have you gone to as far as motivating and helping them increase those numbers?
Well, Brother Frankham, That's part of the reason that I have not allowed the High Priest Group Leader and the Elders Quorum President to reduce my load.
Gotcha.
Because in their PPIs, I want them to say, you know, well, Brother Smith, you only have two families. You can't home teach them. The bishop has eight, and he's getting 80% of them. Now, and I don't get home 100% home teaching every month. Sometimes it is a challenge.
Sure.
But generally speaking, you know, I do make a good effort, and that's, you know, one of the things I've also encouraged the leaders in the ward, the Relief Society president, and who has caught the vision, by the way, and the High Priest Group and the Elders Quorum to think outside the box. And, you know, if you have a difficult family that does not really want any contact with the church, then what can you do to get your foot in the door? And, you know, they all laugh because I believe in the gospel of pie. And if you bake a homemade pie and you take it to somebody, they're going to accept it. And that's the way to do it. I work with a brother at school. He is a great guy. He's not married to an LDS woman, but he is a wonderful man. She's a wonderful woman. Does not want any contact with the church, but I talk to him every day, and we have become very good friends. And so much so that, you know, they're expecting their second child here in a couple months, and he's told me some of the issues dealing with that. And so, you know, if the members would understand that home and visiting teaching is first about becoming a friend, then it would be so much easier. To invite people to come into your home, and they will reciprocate. And, you know, if you remember their children's birthdays, if you remember them when you go on vacation, send them a postcard. Many, many years ago, I taught it was a sister and her husband. They were an older couple and lived in a tiny little travel trailer, and went over and were sitting there. And I don't even know what caused me to look up, but they had a tiny little living room that led right into the kitchen. And around the ceiling of the kitchen, that sister had put every postcard that I had sent them. It was all the way around the ceiling. And that was, you know, I talked about Minute Particulars by William Blake. That was a minute particular. And that really, for me, it was a tender mercy that the Lord says, see, you do make a difference in somebody's life. So
awesome. Awesome payday as a home teacher.
That was an awesome payday. Yes, it was.
Cool. Well, my final question is as you look back, obviously, as you're even back on throughout your life home teaching and being an Elders Quorum president now as a bishop, how has serving as a leader made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
It has. You know, I've been thinking about this since I got your email. It helps me understand an eternal perspective. And I think that's one of the things I would probably also caution the next bishop. So often we feel like things have to happen tomorrow, or we've got a week to do this, or we're under the crunch to do this. But the Lord is very patient with each and every one of us. And as the bishop over these past 5 years, I have truly felt his patience with me as an unworthy servant, as a spiritual son of my Heavenly Father who has, you know, wandered off the path many times and come back on. So I truly feel that sense of eternal patience and love on my behalf. And as a bishop, I feel that patience as I work with the members of the ward, whether they've got big problems or small problems. And yes, I would like to get out my magic wand and wave it and take away those problems. But, you know, for some of these members, they've been dealing with issues for the better part of their lives. And it is very humbling because it makes me reflect as well and think of the tender mercies of the Lord in my life and the blessings he's given me, unworthy though I might be of them.
That concludes my interview with Bishop Scott Bumbaugh. What a fantastic individual, and he's nearing the end of 5 years, and who knows when he'll be released, but I for sure know that he can be released with confidence knowing he's done a fantastic job, and as he's a man, just very sincere individual, and I learned a lot from him, and I hope you did as well. As always, I encourage you to visit leadinglds.com/help, H-E-L-P, and look at the variety of ways that you can help contribute to Leading LDS to get this message out to as many as possible so we can help as many leaders as possible become better and more able leaders. One of those ways that you can help is to go to Facebook and join the Leading LDS Helpers Facebook group. It's a closed group, a private group that I'll let you in if you request it and behave as you're in there. But it's a great group and we have some good discussions going. For instance, we had a recent discussion go back and forth, really good perspectives and thoughts shared about what a stake president does when somebody comes to them that has opposed, you know, in general conference, there was the, you know, those public opposition that you hear in the background. And then President Uchtdorf forwarded them or referred them to their stake president, and individuals talked that said, you know, what does that mean? What does a stake president say? And so we got in this discussion about opposing votes, what that means, what you do, what's the doctrine behind it, and so forth. Really interesting discussion. So I encourage you to go to Leading LDS Helpers Group in Facebook and request to join, and I'll let you in and join in on the fun. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.